The following conversation is about mature subject matter, and listener discretion is advised. Hi! Hey, welcome to The Cordial Catholic, a podcast for non-Catholics, new Catholics, and those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic faith. I'm K. Albert Little, an evangelical convert to Catholicism, and this podcast is born out of one particular idea. It began for me when a Protestant pastor I was working for asked me the question, what's more important, the Bible or tradition? That led me onto a deep dive into church history. I looked into the history of the biblical canon, the history of the early church, how they worshipped and what they believed, the Reformation, and I bumped into Catholic theology along the way. And it was then, as I began to read from Catholic sources about what Catholics actually believed, it was then that I realized that I didn't have a clue about what Catholics actually believed, what the church actually taught. Well, this podcast serves to fill in that same gap. The gap between what you think Catholics believe and what we actually do. Each week, I have a real Catholic conversation with a real Catholic thinker from the heart of the Catholic Church. No misinformation here. And this week, I sit down to talk to Faith Hakesley. Faith is an author, a blogger, a speaker, and a survivor of clerical sexual abuse. We're tackling that subject head-on with a discussion revolving around the question of why remain Catholic? Why become Catholic? Why stay Catholic in the face of sexual abuse? This, for me, hit home recently in my own parish, and over the course of doing this show, it has popped up often as well. It was recently when a friend confided to me that the Catholic Church looks good to them. It looks true. It looks beautiful, but these scandals are just too much. And how can it be true in the face of all this sexual abuse, all these scandals? And if this is the kind of thing that's driving Catholics away from the church, that's preventing others from seeing its beauty, well then, we, faithful and devout Catholics, have to face this head on. This is my attempt. I've spoken before about this idea. Back in episode 45, I had His Excellency Bishop Thomas Dowd on the show, a good friend of the podcast, about confronting the abuse crisis at a systemic level. Here, in this episode, we're going to get a little bit more personal. I'll share my own story, how sexual abuse impacted our parish, and we'll dig in with Faith into how to face up to these kinds of traumas, how to address them, and how in the world do people not just give up and walk away. It's a truly important conversation, and I hope this will help many, many people. That's my goal. It began for me on a Sunday afternoon in the middle of the pandemic. I was walking back from the park with our kids. Our family hadn't been back to Mass since March, since the parishes in our area were closed down during lockdown, but I'd been back, just me, about 2 weeks prior. I was the coordinator for our parish's RCIA program, the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults, the program for adult converts to the Catholic faith. Normally, these converts joined the church at Easter, but because of the lockdowns, it wasn't until July, at a semi-private Mass, a dozen or so of these new Catholics were welcomed into the church. It was one of those new Catholics who first texted me. Hey, where's the parish live stream today? He said. Since early on in the pandemic, our parish had been live streaming masses, and since the church capacity was capped at 30%, many still hadn't been back to worship in person. And for that matter, he said, where's the parish Facebook page and the Twitter feed and the YouTube channel? I had no idea, I said. What's going on? I checked for myself, and indeed, all the parish social media accounts have been erased. The YouTube page completely closed down. What was going on? I sent a text to my friend who worked at the parish, the guy I knew who was in charge of filming and producing the weekly masses. Surely he'd know. And his response was immediate. You haven't heard, he said. You better sit down. My heart began to beat really fast. I rushed home with the kids, parked them in front of my wife in the bedroom, and locked myself in the office. What's going on, I said. As soon as he picked up the phone. As it turns out, a letter had been read at Mass that morning. Our pastor had been suspended. My friend filled in the details of the letter, and shortly after our conversation, local papers, websites, and news sources began to trickle out the same information too. It became big news locally. In official statements, the diocese called it a highly credible, substantiated case of professional misconduct, and asked for prayers for those affected by the priest's actions. Police, we learned, had investigated it but hadn't brought any charges, and the case had been referred to the CDF, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, at the Vatican. A move that, according to our diocese's own policies and procedures, is reserved for cases of sacramental sexual abuse. I can't tell you how this shook me. Listeners to this show know that I'm a convert. My wife is a convert as well, and I may have told you before the story of finding a parish. When I became a Catholic, my wife remained for a year a Protestant Christian. She was raised that way. We had a fantastic non-denominational church that we loved, and all of our friends were there. We were deeply involved. When I became Catholic, we kept going there for a while. I also attended Mass. As a family, we decided that we needed to find a parish we could all belong to, even if my wife wasn't converting just yet. The parish I randomly found up when I decided to become Catholic, where I did my RCIA program, was a sleepy little parish with a beautiful church but not much else going on. No programs for kids, no programs for young adults, no outreach or fellowship, and we didn't really fit in there. So I began looking. I'd attended Sunday night masses alone. A different parish each week while we continued to go to a non-denominational church on Sundays. And it's one of those Saturday nights where I happened to cross a little tiny Catholic church about 20 minutes away from our house. I got there and was immediately welcomed by just about everybody in the parish team. I noticed that there were children's programs, youth group programs for families, outreach, fellowship, and most of all, a serious emphasis on the centrality of the sacraments, the Eucharist. It felt like coming home. Not long after we began attending this Mass, at this parish, my wife joined the Catholic Church. She was confirmed and received the Eucharist, and suddenly we were a Catholic family. Our son was baptized shortly afterwards, our daughter was baptized when she was born, and we became deeply invested in this parish. I became deeply invested in our pastor. He was a visionary. And our parish was respected not just across the diocese, but across the country, across North America. We were pioneers. I became involved in catechesis and music ministry and the parish steering committee and became a close and personal friend of the pastor. He became a friend to our family. When the bishop asked him to move parishes to a larger downtown parish serving two major universities, I was one of the first people he talked to at some length. After much discussion, after some heart-wrenching and soul-searching, our family decided to move parishes with him, to uproot our kids from children's ministries we loved, to leave a small group of friends we had been acquiring, and to follow our pastor and his vision to a new parish, to help him start up all the wonderful things he'd done at the previous parish for a brand new group of parishioners. It was a tough decision. Again, we worked hard to get connected. I jumped in with both feet and took on the entire RCIA program just about single-handedly when I was asked. We began the process of investigating children's ministry at the new parish, of launching small groups, of getting a welcome team off the ground and making connections, and suddenly, everything ground to a halt. And I guess the hardest part in the end was just how much we'd invested in the vision of this one pastor. And pastors fail. People fail. And something I learned a long time ago is that our faith can be placed in one person. Not at least a person who isn't also fully God and fully man. I know we shouldn't put our faith in people, but somehow it doesn't make it any easier when people we love and respect and look so highly upon fail. And when that person is a priest, and when the failure is a sexual abuse scandal, well, it does shake your faith. And that's the whole point of this conversation today. How can we remain Catholic? How can people become Catholic in the face of sexual abuses like this? Because it does. It does shake your faith. It certainly shook mine. Here's my fantastic conversation with Faith Hakesley. Please listen and enjoy. Hey guys, and welcome back to the podcast. Thanks for being here again this week. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for tuning in. This is going to be a really good conversation, I think. I'm really excited to bring this to you guys. It's very important. And I'm privileged to have Faith Hakesley on the show. She has a degree in criminal justice from the University of Massachusetts, Lowell. She's a Catholic blogger, a speaker, a survivor of clerical abuse, and the author of Glimmers of Grace, Moments of Peace and Healing Following Sexual Abuse. A fantastic book out from Our Sunday Visitor, and I'm absolutely privileged to speak to her today. Faith, thank you for being here. Welcome to the show, and hello.
Thank you for having me, Keith.
This is, I just said it, but I'm going to say it again, a really important conversation, and you're a great person to have it with. I sometimes find guests find me. I get I get calls, I get emails, I get letters from people who say, hey, you know, I've written this book. Can I be in your show? Can we talk about it? This is a great topic. I said, yeah, maybe. Sometimes, no, this is crazy. I don't want, no, thank you, politely, cordially. And occasionally I kind of stumble into finding guests, and those are often my favorite because that's this providential thing I find that seems to happen. And those always make the best guests. And I don't even remember, honestly, how I stumbled upon your book and you on Twitter and your blog and some of your things you've written. But I found that and instantly thought, this is somebody I have to speak to on the show, because I've been looking for a long time, and listeners know this now. I've told a bit of my story on this program, on this episode, and I've weighed this for a long time, how to present this, how to speak with this, if I need to, if it's important, if it's any of my business to wade into these kind of conversations. And I reflected and thought a lot about it and thought, yes, I know, this is something that I have experienced. People come to me and say, hey, look, this Catholic Church thing seems great, but this thing's in the way. And I thought, I want to tell my story. I want to bring this conversation to light because I think it's important to talk about these things. And then I came across you just very providentially and thought, this is excellent. This is a perfect guest to have on the show. And I got my hands on your book, and it is fantastic, instantly enthralled, fantastic content in there. You speak from the heart, you speak from experience, you speak from a place of understanding this experience and how God can bring you through it, and how he brings those glimmers of grace, as you say. And it's amazing. So thank you. Thank you for the book. Thank you for your work that you do speaking into this area, this field. Thank you. And thanks for being
here. Well, thank you. It's not easy to do, but you know, as I'm sure you have found, when you have a calling, it's like it never goes away. So you have to answer the call. So I'm doing what I can in my own little way. So I hope it helps in some way.
That's a great way of putting it. That's fantastic. So I want to get into it. You face a lot of trauma in your life. I mean, the opening pages,
a little bit.
The opening pages of your book are a little bit shocking for readers. I mean, it's enough for a lifetime, I think, before you even were into adulthood. So if you're comfortable with it, you know, I'd like you to explain in this, you know, as you explain in the book, can you walk us through kind of the abuse you suffered and then what happened afterwards that then triggered a lot of this, seeing a counselor and everything kind of surfacing at once, coming to a head? Because it's a pretty dramatic story. There are a lot of twists and turns in the short explanation you give of it. And it's like, what else can go wrong? My gosh. It's brought you through to an incredible place for you to speak to listeners. So can you go a bit into the catalyst for all of this?
Sure. So first of all, I was raised in a very Catholic home. I looking back now as an adult with my own children, I am so grateful to my parents for that experience growing up, for the example they set, because I'm pretty sure that I wouldn't be where I am in my faith or in my life if it wasn't for that strong backbone that I had growing up as a child. So I definitely grew up loving our Lord, the saints, the Blessed Mother, the sacraments, you know, the rosary, every part of it. And then when I was 15, I got my first job that came from, I was at our parish rectory, and I had grown up in this parish, and so it seemed like a safe place. And I remember even my mom still says to this day that she feels badly that she was excited that, oh wow, my daughter got this job just on Saturdays, and this is going to be great. What a great environment for her to work in. And unfortunately, it was not a great experience. We had a newly ordained priest. He had come over from Colombia. His name was Kelvin Iguabito Rodriguez. He had taught himself English so that he could come to this country and become a priest. And over a course of several months, I got to know him for who he truly was. He was not the lovable, you know, very charismatic, energetic kind of person that everyone in the parish saw him to be. He was very well liked. He started up a Spanish community there. You know, he drew in a lot of the Spanish from our city. So again, he was well loved. And so I suffered several months of sexual abuse. That ended once he was transferred. He was transferred to a different assignment. I won't get into that. There's just so many details in this story, but he was transferred. And the summer after, and again, that was when I was 15. And then the summer after, my oldest brother unexpectedly passed away. Matt was 22. And we had no idea he had a heart condition. And that's what the autopsy ended up showing. Star athlete on his way to a very prestigious grad school. He had a full boat. You know, he was smart, handsome, the whole nine yards. And I found Matt that Sunday morning. It was a July 1st. I think it was 2001. And anyway, that just, his death sent me into a tailspin, because now I was carrying around the burden of two traumas, which, by the way, isn't entirely uncommon when someone has been through one trauma, another trauma causes them to kind of to come forward about it, because they just can't handle that much. What ended up happening was my parents, although they recognized that I was grieving, which is normal, they recognized that my grief went beyond what was normal. So they put me into grief therapy with a Christian therapist. And the very first session, everything she told me about being a mandated reporter completely went over my head. Thank God it did, because I probably wouldn't have said anything. And I told her, you know, everything that had happened. Within the next few weeks, I summoned the courage to tell my parents, and I had always wanted to, but again, this victim mindset, I'm not going to be believed. Who would believe me? It must have been something I did. All these things going around in your head. And they believed me. They didn't ask. The only question they wanted came from my dad. He just wanted to know who did it. Who did it? They were supportive, and what a relief that was, because finally I was able to have some help carrying that cross. And I was given the option. I didn't have to face him in court if I didn't want to. But when I heard that there had been other victims, I chose to face him. Such a difficult decision to make, but I prayed about it, and I just felt that I was being called to do this. The other victims were not minors, and so what had happened between them and my rapist might not have necessarily been considered illegal. One of those situations. So I was the only minor that they knew of at the time, and so I did face him in court. I was 18. It was the summer after high school graduation, and after a 2-week trial, he was found guilty. He was sentenced to prison. He served, I believe, 10 years. He was released in 2013 and deported to his native Colombia. So after that, life went on as best as it could. I did my best to plug through school, got into college. Most days it was really just about putting one foot in front of the other. And I stayed in therapy. My parents, again, I resented them at the time for this, but we kept going to church, even though for a while we went to a different Catholic church, because I was actually being threatened by people in my parish community. So we were going to a different church, and you know, they kept me going. And again, I'm grateful for it now, maybe not at the time, but now I'm grateful. And then, so time went on, and then another big thing happened in 2008, just a couple months before my husband and I got married. Actually, I was given the opportunity to meet privately with Pope Benedict XVI during his apostolic trip to the United States. And so it was, me and four other survivors from the Archdiocese of Boston, and we got to meet privately with him one at a time in the chapel at the Apostolic Nunciature. And that meeting was really what I think put me on the path to truly being able to forgive my abuser and to truly heal. And it was what inspired me in the first place to reach out to other survivors of abuse or to anyone else who had suffered other traumas, because I had other traumas come along unrelated to the abuse, but I dealt with cancer. I dealt with a heart condition. You know, all these traumatic events just kind of made me think, you know, I've got to do something with this. And I have learned over the years that God can bring good out of bad. And one of the last things Pope Benedict said to me was, there is always hope. And I really have carried that message in my heart for years. And that's the message that I try to share with the people who I reach out to. So here we are.
That's remarkable. And thank you. I mean, it takes a certain grace from God.
Oh, yes.
But your yes as well to do these things and to bring these things forward to other people and to be that kind of voice speaking out to these things. So thank you for being there. That's a remarkable amount of trauma. You glossed over the latter parts of the heart condition and cancer.
Oh, yeah. Well,
these things just seem like super easy in light of everything else.
I think at this point, I think when one more thing comes along, I've just gotten to that point. It's like, okay, I'll deal with it. God will help me through. I have been very, very fortunate, and I recognize not everyone has this. I've had a tremendous support system, especially from my parents and my husband. We've been married 12 and a half years. I've had wonderful priests, you know, really a really great support system. When I was writing this book, when I was writing Glimmers of Grace, it just was released this past August. I actually almost died while writing it because of my heart condition. Go figure, right? I can't help but laugh now, just really, really, Lord. But in a way that helped with my writing, because, you know, it's been so long since I was in that position of feeling like such a victim. When you're in the midst of such deep grief, an incident with my heart, you know, that almost took my life, it put me into this deep depression and grief. And it just so happened that it was in the middle of writing my book. But if anything, it was a grace, because it helped me to, I think, better connect with what I was trying to write and with the points I was trying to get across to my readers. So here I was trying to talk to them about grief and suffering and trauma. And there I was going through my own grief, just, you know, different, but it brought back a lot of what I had been through all those years ago with the abuse, the loss of my brother, and all the other stuff. So, what can I say? God is good. He gives you what you need.
Well, you've got a fantastic perspective. I mean, I think anybody would experience one of those things you've listed and just crumble sometimes. So it's a testament to our Lord and the grace he gives us, on one hand, testament to your willingness to receive that and to carry forward in that. And I mean, just to use those things as they're intended to be used. I mean, God gives us those things, and they're all graces. I mean, bad things happen. They happen. But God puts those, God is not surprised by those bad things happening, right? He puts those in, he doesn't make those happen to us, but I guess he allows those to happen. And of course, there's all kinds of episodes we could do on the problem of evil and suffering. And I've done a few of those for sure.
Right.
And had people more intelligent than I have speak about this. But what I'm getting at is, you, I think, have accurately and appropriately approached those things. You have a great perspective. It's the right one to say, these things suck. This is terrible, but I'm going to use them in the way God intended them to move forward and to use these things to help me grow and to reach people who have been impacted likewise and move forward. I mean, that's not an easy perspective to have, but you have adopted that in spite of all these traumas. So, I mean, that's a great example for the rest of us who might suffer nowhere near as many difficulties or struggles as you have, and you move forward in gracefully. I mean, that's amazing.
It takes this practice, and I certainly have my days, and I have my periods of time that, you know, people don't necessarily see where I am a complete mess. And I'm talking, you know, and it's been years since the rape, since my brother's death, you know, all these things. Time has passed. And I think that's an important thing for people to understand about healing, though, is it doesn't happen overnight. And what other people see might not necessarily be, you know, how it is on a daily basis. You know, I am a pretty positive person, and, you know, I try to keep the faith, but there are some days when, my goodness, I feel like a complete wreck, and I'm questioning God and questioning, why am I here? What do you want of me? Haven't I done enough? But like I said, it's that what Pope Benedict said to me always comes back. There's always hope. And I have to hold on to that. And, you know, I hope that other people who read my book or hear my story will realize that there is always hope. And there is a God who's a healer. And he wants so much to help all of us, no matter how small, no matter how big our crosses may be, he's there to help us.
That's so well said. Okay, so what's it like for you when someone in a trusted position, someone so well-liked, as you described this priest as being, to harm you like that? I mean, I can think of my own situation. One of the things that I wrestled with and frankly just devastated me was to think that the first priest our kids ever knew turned out to be a sexual abuser. Like, and they loved that priest. They loved our priest. He was great with the kids. And as far as I know, the abuse that he was accused of didn't involve minors. But you can't undo that. You can't ever get a do-over on the first priest our kids met, right? So, gosh, all I can hope and pray for at this point is that they're so young enough that eventually they'll forget and won't remember this particular priest. But how is it for you? How did you come to terms, or how do you come to terms with the fact that one priest isn't every priest? This was one particular person that my kids first knew that ended up being an abuser. This was one person that you knew, one priest you knew that ended up being an abuser. How do you get past that not every priest is like that, right?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry that happened, because I heard your story, and it's absolutely devastating. It goes to show, this scandal, yes, of course it affects the victims in the most dramatic way, but it betrays every single person within the Catholic Church. Every single faithful Catholic has been betrayed, and it's especially difficult when it hits so close to home. So yeah, it's tough to accept that someone who we love or admire isn't who we thought they were. But it also goes to show, you know, none of us is above the grooming process. Anyone can be groomed. We even learned in the McCarrick Report, even a saint, St. Pope John Paul II, was, you know, apparently groomed and made to think good things about McCarrick that weren't true. And it's humbling. I think it's humbling to admit, you know, I thought this person was a good person. They weren't. I was baptized by a pedophile. This go figure, right? The same man, a man who my parents knew, he was at a local parish at the time. He baptized my twin brother and I. He actually ended up serving time with my rapist years later, oddly enough. So it's tough to wrap our heads around the fact that we have all been groomed by these predators to some degree. We've all kind of been betrayed and taken advantage of. But I think it's also important to keep in mind, this is where I am encouraged to put my faith in Christ alone. Because unfortunately, human beings fail. We see this not just in the church, we see it in the schools, we see it in sports, businesses, Hollywood. Pretty much everywhere you look, you see these horrible, evil acts, these betrayals going on. And so as Catholics, our faith should be in God alone. And it's great when we find those genuinely good, holy priests that can help us on our journeys, that's great. But I think I always ask myself, okay, you know, who is my faith in? Am I trusting in this priest alone, or is it, you know, who they stand for? Is it God? There's no easy way to know who we can trust all the time. There's no magic formula that tells us you can trust him, you can't trust him, you can trust her, but you can't trust her. But yeah, I think I've just reached that point where, okay, why am I here? I'm not here for any priest, bishop, or even for the Pope. I'm here for God. That's why I'm Catholic. That's why I stay in the church. But it's really, really tough, especially as, you know, in your situation, your whole family is affected by this. It's so traumatic, so traumatic. You know, it's just, unfortunately, it's just the reality that we're living in right now. But again, it's not just within the Catholic Church. It's pretty much everywhere you look.
Yeah, one of the truly traumatizing things for me was that I was in charge of the RCAA program. So I was the guy leading all these new Catholics into these new adult converts into the Catholic Church. And literally this broke, I mean, 2 weeks after they'd all just been baptized, confirmed, had their first Eucharist, joined the church. And this was right during the height of COVID. So it was all virtually. So the Mass was in person, and I hadn't seen any of these folks for weeks. We'd moved to virtual RCAA for the last few weeks of it, and finally our church was opened up again, and we had this Mass immediately as soon as we could, and then did a few more virtual meetings. And gosh, to look at those people on the screen, you know, these 12 or so people who had just been baptized and confirmed and received the first Eucharist, and then this news broke of this alleged abuse, and it was... I just sat there and stared at them and said, you know, because literally the first, I think, and for our family, the first priest my kids have ever known, this is the situation. This was horrible enough, and this will remain horrible forever for my kids and for us, that memory. But then these very new Catholics, the first priest they knew, the priest who just brought them into the church, and then all this breaks. And I mean, I didn't even have the words to say to them. I'm like, guys, this isn't all priests, but you have no context whatsoever for any other priest that's out there. It's crazy. And then how do you, you know, I try to put myself in their shoes and try and address those feelings, but I don't know how you, gosh, it takes a lot of praying and thinking and speaking to qualified people who weren't me in that case, maybe to get past like how you meet other priests and don't have that prejudice already built into you. Because the first priest we ever knew was like this. I mean, it's what a barrier to the faith for these brand new Catholics, right? That just, that killed me. It was terrible.
But it's in a way it's a test for them and for you. Because again, it goes back to that question, why did I become Catholic? Is it because of this priest? Now, just because this priest he clearly did some horribly evil things. That doesn't take away, I'm not saying we should hold him on a pedestal. That's not what I'm saying at all. He clearly gets some serious, serious issues. But it doesn't take away from the good that he may have done. You know what I mean? So... But it's tough. My own husband kind of went through a similar situation. He went through RCIA and he loved this particular priest. Guess what? This priest came out that this priest had done things that he shouldn't have done. It was a consensual relationship with someone else, but you know, there was no abuse of minors, but regardless, he was doing things he wasn't supposed to be doing. And it was devastating. And my husband kind of went through this same feeling. This was the first priest who he had felt a connection with, who he really felt was bringing him in. And I had to remind him, you know, you can still hang on to the things that he taught you. He may have taught you some good, you know, I reminded him again, there are good holy priests. I've been fortunate to have several of them in my life, still do. But again, it all comes down to, okay, why did you become Catholic? Because if you became Catholic for that priest, it's not the right reason to become Catholic. I mean, good for you. Now you're Catholic and you're in the church, but you know, at some point you're going to have to say goodbye to that priest. As you know, they're often kind of moved around, and you get some good ones, you get some not so good ones. And I've been grateful to some of the less good ones. And I don't mean priests who are doing terrible things. I just mean those priests that really don't make much of an impression on you. You know, I'm grateful for them, or the priests you don't necessarily agree with on a lot of things. But I'm grateful for them because, again, it keeps my focus not on them, but on God, which is the reason that I'm there.
Such a good point. And you're right in what you say. I mean, we as a group, I mean, me and these new Catholics as a group, we grew tremendously close, and we grew tremendously in faith, praying the rosary together and meeting for weeks after our classes had ended, just to kind of pray together and talk together. And I mean, I can say for myself, my spiritual life grew by leaps and bounds through that experience, because I had nothing else to cling on to. I mean, I truly needed to cling on to God and say, why is this going on? Like, you know, I need, and just pray. And as a group, I mean, these new Catholics, I mean, hopefully they're not going to pattern their lives after yours and just and have trauma after trauma after trauma. I mean, like, you're taking it all for us, I think, it sounds like. But I mean, they have had, you know, a very difficult experience right at the beginning of becoming Catholic. So that's going to form them into hopefully an incredible Catholic. I mean, that's going to really grow their faith. And like you said, which I think is very poignant, they're going to have to recognize very quickly that we can't cling on to anybody like this. This is going to draw them hopefully closer. And it has. I mean, it has firsthand. I know that it has drawn them closer to God and their Catholic faith, apart from one or two priests or even what I taught them. I mean, forget me. They've grown closer to God through this. And I think that's remarkable. And that's a great point you brought up.
And plus, I got to say, anyone who, knowing what people know about the scandal and the corruption that is still within the church, anyone who becomes a Catholic now, they're either completely nuts or they really have a deep faith and they get it. Yeah. So I have to say, the people who are that I hear about who are becoming Catholic, even now, even knowing about McCarrick and the scandal and all these horrible things, wow, I feel like they're going to be some of our strongest soldiers, you know, fighting for Christ, because wow, to join in the midst of all that. And I feel the same way about anyone who wants to become a priest in these times. Again, you're either nuts or you've got a tremendously strong, you know, strong faith. And, you know, you are listening to God and, you know, wow, I admire those people so much. And yet we have Catholics who have been, you know, cradle Catholics like me, who are leaving in droves, like, I give up. And yet we have people just so anxious to come in. Yeah. Wow. That tells you something. There's something here. There's something about this church that's pretty incredible. God's doing wonderful things.
That's a great point. And I think too of some of the members of this group who pulled me through in some cases. There are some days when I get a text, you know, how you doing? I'm like, I'm this is terrible. I'm devastated. And they'd pull me through. These brand new Catholics would have the faith to pull me through. And I thought, this is amazing. I mean, this is incredible. What a blessing. Mm. Your book came out around the same time as the McCarrick Report, you mentioned, in the U.S. And this was a massive years-long investigation into this disgraced American Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. And as far as I can tell, the investigation uncovered a kind of a massive trove, if you will, of abuse and other, you know, other cardinals and bishops and people in power, kind of maybe turning their heads, looking the other way in some cases. And you want to hope and pray that when abuse occurs, it's dealt with swiftly and appropriately. And this report, I think, and some of the more recent reforms under Pope Francis have put some of these things in place. And there are good things, and this report shows the system is working in some case. But at the same time, the kind of systematic abuses uncovered in the McCarrick Report show that at least at one point it wasn't working. So the system was corrupt, I mean, to the core in some cases. And that, for me, makes it a bit hard to move on sometimes, move past these abuses, when you know that in some cases this system is maybe not working how it should. What do you make of that, this kind of systemic problem?
It's really tough to wrap my head around. And I can't go near the McCarrick report as far as, like, I don't think I will be able to read, especially not now. I'm close to, you know, giving birth at this point to our fourth child. Emotionally, I'm a wreck already. I can't handle anything else right now. But yeah, it definitely, I mean, my faith in the people part of the church has definitely been shaken. I don't have a lot of trust for the USCCB. I have trouble trusting the Vatican. But again, it all comes back to, okay, why am I Catholic? I'm not Catholic even for the Pope. I'm Catholic for Jesus. There is corruption. There's this whole, I think it goes all the way up the ranks, starting in the seminary, going all the way up to high people in the Vatican. And it's clear that people are covering for one another or else turning a blind eye. And, you know, and there, I think there are a lot of cases too, in which these priests and bishops have been groomed by these predators. And so they have no idea that they too are being betrayed. They're being taken advantage of. And, I think it's just, it's reached a point where I think a lot of these guys, it's like they're a bunch of hoarders and they don't know, they know they have to clean house, but they don't even know where to begin because they are just so overwhelmed. There's just filth and junk just piled up on all sides and they're all just kind of, I don't know what to do. What do we do now? I'm grateful for the McCarrick report in that I think it sort of sets a precedent as far as, hopefully it's a step in the right direction as far as transparency goes. I do wish that it had been put together, that an investigation had been taken place by some, like, a third party. When something comes directly from the Vatican these days, I tend to kind of go, not sure I completely trust it. Like, can I trust it? So I definitely still have those issues where, you know, that issue of, I don't know who to trust as far as the people who are running things. But I just say, if we keep our Lord at the front, at the forefront of everything we do, and just fight the good fight, just keep up the faith. You know, we definitely have to fight for justice, but we have to keep God in front of us at all times. Otherwise, we're just going to become discouraged and walk away, as we've seen a lot of people do.
Yeah, that's a great perspective. I don't know that there's a better one or a different one for Catholics these days, other than, as you say, to give up and walk away, because what else can we do? And I'm heartened by, I had Bishop Thomas Dowd of Montreal on this program up here in Canada. And he's a fantastic priest who made, like, national news because he actually accompanied, he uncovered some abuse and accompanied one of the victims to file. He wrote this, like, 700-page report for this victim, investigated all these priests and wrote this report and brought it to the police station with this victim and sat with him, you know, waiting to file this police report. Those examples for me are like, you know, glimmers of hope, glimmers of
yeah,
you know, those are,
they get it. Guys, yeah, like him, they get it. Yeah.
So that for me is heartening, right? But that the whole system is not necessarily broken, but gosh, it's hard sometimes when abuse comes to light. I can think of lots of occasions, not even as high profile as the McCarrick report, where it's just handled so poorly. And I mean, it's so tone deaf. And some of the response I heard to the McCarrick report from places that I really trust and value that report on these things very well, commentary that said, you know what, there wasn't an apology in there. It was a factual report, but we as Catholics just want someone to say, I'm sorry, in some cases, right? I'm sorry this happened. So there's that, you know, there's that you hope, and I hope that these things are handled properly. I mean, it must have been for you very difficult in these cases of abuse that, I mean, that you experienced, that your husband experienced, this encounter of this priest who wasn't very holy, I guess, or didn't make very good choices. It's hard to let go and let the system kind of work when you know the system isn't always working as it really should be in a Christ-like, a transparent, clear. I mean, I think of Christ as going and like flipping the tables in the temple, right? I mean, he was pretty he was pretty transparent in when he saw injustice, how this should be solved. And I feel like too often in the Catholic Church, it's just the approach, the systemic approach to it, just fails to look really Christ-like, right? It's just a painting.
I definitely feel like there's sort of this brotherhood in a way, like I'll cover for you, you cover for me. And I know that even in my own case, that people knew that in the seminary, my abuser was a womanizer. It was known, but people covered for him. And when someone tried to come forward and say something, he was pushed out. And, you know, unfortunately, there's just this kind of culture that has been allowed to grow in the church. This evil has been allowed to infiltrate. And of course, we know where it comes from. The devil, this is exactly what the devil wants. He wants this chaos. He wants this corruption and scandal. He wants this division. But we just have to, you know, I always keep in mind the fact that Jesus never promised that his church would never suffer. You know, even St. Peter, the first pope, denied Jesus three times. you know, sometimes you look at the apostles and some of the things that they did and you think, really? Like, they were with the Son of God and they still did these really dumb things. You know, so we can't ever expect that everything is just going to be hunky-dory within the church. You know, we do, praise God, we have our Lord, we have his mother who promised us at Fatima, in the end, my Immaculate Heart will triumph. And no matter what happens, you know, again, he never said it was going to be easy, but God is with us. He's helping us fight this battle. And, you know, I believe Pope Benedict said many years ago that he believed that one day the church would be smaller, but more faithful. And I truly believe that that's where we're headed.
I didn't send you the notes I'm looking at here on my screen, but I had this written down, underlined, that quote from Pope Benedict. Oh. Because as you're saying these things, I'm thinking, yes, this is what has got to happen, right? And I love the example you mentioned of the hoarders just hoarding up things and don't even know where to begin. And that's when I thought of this quote from Pope Benedict, right? That and I believe it's a prophetic word. I think it's absolutely true that the church is going to have to become smaller and shed some of the structure and baggage that is corrupting, that is not working well, some of this stuff. And the people, as you say, that are leaving the church, because what are they really here for? I mean, it's tricky because, I saw a great therapist who said to me, you know what, you have permission for a bit to just not feel like you have to go to church, and that's okay. I mean, he was a Christian therapist. He wasn't Catholic. So I don't think he understood the obligation. We were under dispensation anyway during COVID at the point. So he was technically right.
Yeah.
But you know, his point was it's okay to feel like you want to leave right now. Gosh, you pray those people that have left. And I'm sure there's lots of people who have left over issues of abuse. Gosh, you pray they come back and God draws them back in again. And I mean, the joke I make with the RCIA folks whenever I teach the course is, hey, once you're baptized Catholic, you're Catholic. You can't undo that. Yeah. It's an indelible mark on your soul. So sorry, like you're in now, no matter what you do. Yeah. So you hope that grace they received God will continue to work through that. I mean, pray for those people who have left the church. I mean, that's something I always pray for. And this podcast that's a big deal in this podcast. It's tough though, and I think that, as you said, and as Pope Benedict commented, the church is going to become more lean, more smaller, made up of people who really want to be in it, not in it to groom others and to maintain this network I mean, you think of some of these abusers who were in it for the power and the prestige and the elevation and the moving up in the ranks, right? I mean, those people, you know, through the winnowing fork or through flames will be will be removed, you know, by the grace of God and by, I think, good clergy and lay people like ourselves and like you advocating for these things. I think this is the way forward, and I think that we'll see this in the coming decade, years and decades, and however it fleshes out, right? I think this is the direction, and I think it seems to be the case. You make a point in your book of explaining that it isn't necessarily a book about forgiveness, and I'm not sure if I'm getting that right or not, so maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the impression that I got when I began to read it, and it struck me as strange, but then as you unfold that a little bit more, I thought, yeah, okay, I'm tracking with you. Why is it important that it's not like about forgiveness as the central thing?
You know, it's funny. The very last, it's separated into different reflections with like different gifts that God gives you, such as acceptance, joy, peace, faith, hope, different things. My very last one was originally forgiveness. And I kept looking at it, and I just told my editor, something just doesn't feel right with this. And I ended up changing it to freedom. And here's why. Because I recognize that a lot of people who might pick up this book might be people who have never come forward before, that they might be just coming to terms with something that happened to them. And everyone heals differently. But one of the things that personally bothered me was when people would kind of say right off the bat, and they meant well, you got to forgive them. And in the back of my mind, I know, but you can't just force forgiveness. So I can't just go up to a survivor of any kind of abuse and say, you know, you really got to get over this. You got to forgive. You know, there's this whole mentality of forgive and forget. And that is so, so harmful. We are allowed to be angry. There's nothing wrong with being angry. And some people, again, everybody grieves, everyone heals differently. So there may be some people who are able to forgive right off the bat. But I think for most of us, it takes time to truly forgive. And so I put the last reflection in the book is actually freedom. And it sort of alludes to forgiveness, even though I don't mention it. But I recognize that just the word forgive might be kind of a trigger word for some survivors. And I don't want to put that pressure on them. Again, as a Catholic, I know that we are called to forgive just as Jesus forgave. But I think God understands that it's not something that it's just like, all right, this happened. All right, forgive. It doesn't happen that way. It just doesn't for the majority of us. So I didn't want to make this about forgiveness, but rather about slowly, you know, that slow journey of healing, that gradual journey that eventually gets you to the point where you are able to free yourself from those chains that bind you, the chains of the hate, the resentment. And the other thing is too, you know, forgiveness is such a broad topic. You can write, I mean, there are whole books about forgiveness. And again, it's not just like healing doesn't happen overnight. Forgiveness does not just happen overnight. So I never want to, just like I'm never going to talk to a survivor and say, you need to be going to church. I kept going to church most of the time. So should you. We're not all coming from the same place. Our experiences are all different. And I wanted to honor that. So that was the main reason why I didn't specifically address forgiveness. I termed it as freedom, sort of alludes to it. And I hope that that's something that will kind of come naturally to people after, you know, when they're able to get through the book, read all the other reflections, then maybe forgiveness is something that they will slowly over time be able to consider.
Yeah, that's a great point. You're very insightful. It's a fantastic book. It really is. And that's the thing. You encounter this. And I mean, I encountered this in a small way. I didn't experience directly any kind of abuse, but you get this. You get this idea that, okay, you have to, as a Christian, you have to accept this. You have to take this on, work through this, and then forgive and move on. And if you don't forgive, you're you're shamed somehow for not forgiving. And it's very insightful that you say, talk about again, the time it takes. Like healing, forgiveness takes time. And when I first heard this, I talked to a great therapist and he mentioned, okay, well, yes, this will come. Because it was a while. And I was like, I just don't feel like I can like let this go. Or I don't feel like I can forgive this. I just feel so angry all the time. And what am I going to, how do I ever stop feeling angry? And his comment was, it takes time. And you will, and you do. But it's not a thing that anyone can demand of you to forgive this person. And I mean, we know that as Catholics, as Christians, we're called to forgive, as you said. But it can't be a thing that is demanded of us. And if we don't forgive, then all of a sudden we're shamed, and that just becomes this vicious cycle. And we can't put that on ourselves either, right? We can't put it on ourselves that even when nobody else is telling me you have to forgive, to feel for yourself, I have to forgive and move on, to internalize that, then you're in a battle with yourself, right? And I think that's no good either.
It's more genuine and when you are able to take the time that it takes. I personally, I just got to a point where I was constantly walking around in almost like a fog. It was always at the front of my mind, the hate, the anger, the resentment. It was always there. And I remember my dad telling me, "You've got to find a way to let go," because he knew he had to. He's a father. I mean, a father I'm his only daughter. So his little girl was hurt, and boy, he was. I can't even describe how angry that poor man was, and still is. You know, anger isn't necessarily a bad thing either. But he told me that he was carrying around such resentment that he had to let it go because it was taking over every part of his life. And, you know, it's been about, I think, 20 years for me since the abuse. And I still have to make a conscious decision every now and then to forgive again. Forgiveness, the other thing I've learned is that forgiveness, yes, it takes time, but it also isn't just a single moment where, oh, I forgive you and we're done with it. When the McCarrick report came out, when I've gotten criticisms from people on social media, when people say things to me, things come back and it hurts. And that old, you can feel that old anger, that old resentment just creeping up again. And you have to just kind of pray, surrender it to God, say, I'm really struggling right now. I feel like I'm headed back to where I was. And over time, you learn the ways to be able to, I don't want to say not suppress it, but deal with the emotions as they come, give them to God, and forgive all over again. It's not an easy thing to do. It takes a lot of practice. I struggle with it big time. Again, especially when these big things happen, when I hear another report about yet another case, it's just, oh, come on. You know, all these, and then I have to forgive all over again, not just by my rapist, but the people who supported him, the bishops and the priests who are still covering for other people. You know, there's a whole list. And you just have to, it's part of trusting in God and surrendering in a way. And again, it's not an easy thing to do. All we can do is just try our best.
Yeah. Well, that's very insightful and very well said. The last thing I want to ask you is really the crux of this conversation for me. You know, I've said before on this show, but I can clearly remember when I was becoming Catholic, I had just begun RCAA, and this is the process for adult converts to become Catholic. And the Spotlight movie came out, the film documenting some of the abuse taking place at the hands of priests in Boston. And somebody who heard I was becoming Catholic, well-meaning, said to me, why? Why do you become Catholic with all this abuse going on? And it was a valid question, right? I mean, honestly, at the time, I had two thoughts. And the first was, well, because it's true. The Catholic Church is true, and I want to be part of that. That was my first thought, maybe naively a little bit. And the other thought was, well, it'll never happen to me. Abuse would never happen to me, and not to anyone that I know, not in my diocese, not in my parish. It wouldn't happen. And as front and center as these scandals were back then, and even more recently, you know, it wouldn't happen to me. And then it did in our parish. And the abuser was a priest who was like a best friend to me and to our family, and beloved by everyone in the parish. And for the first time since becoming Catholic, that terrifying question flashed in my mind. You know, why would you want to become Catholic? Only now it was, why remain Catholic? Why remain Catholic in the face of so much abuse? And I don't want to put this all on you as if you have the ultimate answer to this question, but
you know what?
Maybe you do, because in this conversation, you're very insightful, but you do have an answer to that question. And so maybe I'm going to ask you this, because I really want to know, how would you answer that question? Why, in the face of all of this, all of your trauma at the hands of some priests of the Catholic Church, quite literally, why remain Catholic?
Well, I think, you know, the whole, what you said about, you know, this Jesus founded this church, that's part of it. But for me, more than anything, it's what I said earlier. My faith is in Christ alone. I am not a Catholic for any priest, any nun, any bishop, any pope. I'm Catholic because I believe this is the one true faith, because I believe in the sacraments. And just, I think, because of my own experiences have shown me that there is just more meaning to life when I have my Catholic faith. And during times when I've kind of been, even though I've never completely abandoned it, there's certainly been times when I've backed away a bit. And I just, there was something missing. And I don't know why I experienced that, and some people don't. And that's why I will never judge, you know, any survivor who says, I can't walk into a church. Listen, I know what it's like to just drive by a church, to even try to walk into a church and you are physically ill. I used to pass out just being in church because the triggers, the emotions were just so intense. I couldn't handle being there. And it's tough, you know. The betrayal of a priest, something like that, you're not only physically hurt, but it's emotional and it's spiritual. So where's your crutch? You're trying so hard to focus on Jesus, but all these memories come back, and it feels like you've been robbed. Everything you hold dear has been taken. I mean, we're talking about your faith, which is at the core of so many people's lives. And when you feel that, you know, when that has been betrayed, the person who's supposed to be bringing you closer to the faith, yeah, it's tough to get up and just kind of keep going along. But I know that in Christ, especially in the sacraments, we're the only religion that can boast to having His Jesus himself, the same Jesus that healed people and did miraculous things all those years ago, that died for us and rose from the dead, we are receiving him. No other religion has that. And in his presence, in the sacraments, there is healing and hope. And I can't imagine, I don't know where else I would find that. Therapy is wonderful. You know, I've been lucky to have you know, a Christian therapist in the past. And then, you know, a few years ago, I was seeing a Catholic therapist, really, really wonderful, good support, all that. But all of that stuff is good. The self-care, the devotionals, what I've found that I need is nothing compares to Jesus himself. And where else can I find that? Nowhere else, no other human being. It's only through the Eucharist, through the sacraments, and it's not easy. I have trouble going to confession, you know, I think for pretty obvious reasons. I still, the white collar that the priests typically wear, I still have trouble with that sometimes. These are all things I've tried to work on, you know, in therapy and you know, but I am Catholic because, again, in his presence, there is just such tremendous healing and hope that I'm not going to find anywhere else. So I'm going to stick with it as best as I can. And I realize that for some people, that's going to look different, especially if someone is someone who has suffered, you know, clerical abuse and they have not had the help that, you know, the help that they deserve. My heart goes out to them. But I do encourage people to hang on to the fact that Jesus is our hope. He is our healer.
Yeah, very well said. And thank you. Thank you for sharing that. This has been a really a privilege for me to have this conversation with you. And I'm really grateful that we were able to make this connection and for you coming on this show and sharing so passionately and so insightfully. I mean, this is fantastic. So thank you. Where can listeners go to find out more about you, to pick up this book, to check out your blog and resources that you have there? Where do you want to point them towards?
I have a website. It's called faithhakesley.com. I'll spell that because no one knows how to spell my last name. It's www.faith, as in faith, hope, love, F-A-I-T-H, Hakesley, H-A-K-E-S-L-E-Y.com. I have a blog on there. It's called Faith Restored. I recently opened up my blog. I want to hear from other survivors of trauma, not just abuse, but just any kind of trauma, anyone who has felt God's healing presence in their life. I would love to be able to share their story. I know a lot of people feel that call to share what they've been through, but they don't necessarily have a platform. So I have tried to open that to people. And I have a books page on there, so you can find all the links to the Our Sunday Visitor bookstore, and as well as Amazon, to be able to purchase that book. You can follow me on social media, all that good stuff. Although at this point, I will forewarn you, I'm starting to slow down. This baby's coming. Mama's tired. So,
oh, well, congratulations and thank you. And I'll put links to all those in the show notes for this show as well, so listeners can find that. Gosh, thank you for this conversation. I want to say God bless you. God bless the fantastic work you are doing for the church, truly. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Keith. I appreciate it. God bless you.
God bless you too. Well, it certainly wasn't an easy conversation to have, but hopefully you got something out of that indeed. My huge thanks to Faith Hakesley for sharing that fantastic perspective with us, for writing her book and for speaking and doing that blogging work. It's enormous stuff. It's important. It's fantastic. So thank you to Faith. Please check out her website in the show notes for this show. TheCordialCatholic.com is our website, cordialcatholic@gmail.com, for your feedback. I'd love to hear from you on this topic and any other topic you hear about on this show. Tell me who you are, where you're listening from, and why, oh why, you continue to listen. I appreciate all your feedback, guys. The Cordial Catholic on Facebook, at Cordial Catholic on Twitter. And please do follow this podcast if you can on the platform that you use. Please subscribe to it. Please leave those ratings and reviews if you can. Those ratings and reviews are so important to push this podcast out to new people and to spread the message of the Catholic Church. That'd be fantastic, guys. Patreon.com/cordialcatholic or paypal.me/cordialcatholic to help support this show. Thanks to those who already are giving to this show and helping to underpin financially the work of this podcast. Thanks, guys. You're wonderful. Thank you once again for listening, guys. I do appreciate it. Please pray for me. Know that I am praying for you as well. And I'll talk to you again next week, friends. This is a tough topic, and hopefully if you're in a place where you need help on this thing, on this particular topic, on a sexual abuse issue, please reach out and find that help. FaithHakesley.com is a fantastic resource for that. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcatholic. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.